an inner figure like that,
yeah.
Woman. And, you know, it kind of makes sense if we skip that phase that she'd have to show up at some point.
Well, I'm not sure who she is then, if she's not the Hestia.
Well, maybe I don't know who Hestia is.
Well, Hestia is the goddess of the heart,
sort
of the mother. Well,
no, no, not Hestia.
She's sexy, but not in a broadcasting kind of way.
No, this is more of a goddess of the light and dark.
I would say I've had that something similar to that in my dreams.
Well, that's the figure, that inner guiding figure I'm talking about. That I think I've seen then. Yes.
In fact, my initial dream
is
now.
Yeah?
She looks like Aphrodite to me.
Yeah.
Aphrodite, huh?
No?
Yeah. The picture, yeah, there are old pictures of Aphrodite don't look like that. When she's rolling up.
Yeah, but she's coming. Aphrodite doesn't emphasize the sun and the moon, does she?
Well, I don't know. I see.
She's all about
what you're saying.
She's all about light and dark.
I see what you're saying.
And she's turquoise. That's the color of Sophia too. So she's got that going for her.
So, bottom line, she incorporates the spiritual element as well, I think. That's what you're driving at, huh?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm driving at, I guess.
Well, whatever it is, it's important. And we sure should be great to have some women work on this. Ahem, ahem.
You know, he said women.
Yeah.
I've seen this artist before. Who is this? Bridget Marlin. But there I get the feeling that she's in the earth and yet she's above it. You know, she's above and below. And here in this particular painting, she's concerned with violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She's
and the sun is enclosed in the moon. Mm-hmm. And that's how the sun is enclosed in the moon, encircled by the moon.
I'm not sure if that's what that means, but she says there's an ocean in the background, which I didn't perceive at first. But you notice that the opposites arrayed beside her, the ones on the left are empty.
Empty, and mm-hmm. they're full.
And the ones on the right are full.
Mm-hmm.
And uh-huh. the ones on the left are the dark, and the ones on the right. And yet, on each side, they're light and dark. So it's she's all about the opposites, which is why I say she's not just a moon earth figure.
Mm-hmm. I like that she's kind of middle-aged looking a little bit too.
Well, exactly. I've seen her appear in all three of the traditional aspects, you know, maiden, mother, and crone. Mm-hmm. But here she's not even at cronage, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm serious. I hope some of you guys start working on this and maybe come up with a lecture on it. Collect dreams from women on how is the self manifesting. I'm sure it's different than it was manifesting 50 years ago.
And the artist I talked to, it's like Jung says, when it's in a dream, a lot of times it's some sort of symbolic thing like a diamond or a flower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But when you interact with it, it's this.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Yeah. Because it has to be personified in order to have this feeling relationship
mm-hmm.
with it, or
mm-hmm.
something like
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
I have rectangles in my dreams. Well, here comes some rectangles. In perspective, they're rectangles.
Yeah.
If you're looking straight down on it, it's a square.
This is interesting. The book, The Best Tobacco Money Can Buy. That's what it looks like. It's in the quartel.
What looks like the best tobacco money?
The book, the title of the book.
Oh, I think it's J.G. Ballard's,
Not Tobacco? Then?
No.
Okay.
It's Ballard's book. And the artist had did portraits of Ballard and had a relationship with him. I think his books were like social commentary on England and that kind of thing.
Hmm. He doesn't know about that.
No, that is a colleague of mine. when I was talking last week about the, as von Braun calls it, the Juno figure, that, you know, seemed to be missing from early in the experience. And I said that I felt that I was seeing a figure like that in some artists.
Well, thank you. Let's keep our eye on that. It's very important, I think. And I'm glad you raised the question. Let's just do a quick review. Again, welcome back. John will be here, and Jane is in Florida. What we've been doing is looking at the figures in history that anticipate what the self is. We talked about the genius, we talked about Hermetic philosophy, that's the philosophy around Hermes that kind of took root, I'm not sure exactly when, but I think if not before Christ, in the Hellenistic period after Christ, around Alexandria, I believe, Egypt, so Hellenized Egypt. And we got some descriptions of this guide or the pattern, or the shepherd. And then we stopped talking about the image in woman. And that was 155. And then what she talks about there, 155.
Oh, there's a comic in Japan called The Most Fruitful Yuki, and she's a pregnant teenager. I'm sorry, just on that note, I thought of you.
I might know this.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We have a paragraph left on this stuff, 155, the bottom to 156. Her basic point is, why is it the phonic figure that is present in dreams? And she says that the issue is because it embodies all the dark qualities, cunning, cruelty, wickedness, depths of passion, a tigress. And the importance of living these aspects. See, I think a lot of that stuff has been lived, really, thanks to Bette Midler. I'm serious. I mean, she represented that aspect of femininity, which has, I think, found a place. Much more.
You could find some women from the 1920s, too.
Right.
Like, what's that dancer's name? Baker?
Josephine Baker.
Yeah, various women like that.
Those women all ended up dead.
Dead.
Didn't they?
So you're saying you feel the dark aspect has already been lived, but then she's saying that she finds the phonic mother.
Yeah, but this is written 40 years ago.
And then last week you said that's what you saw too?
I'm not sure what I'm seeing.
Oh.
I certainly have seen it, but I have never sat down to kind of come up with a panorama and then look for predominances.
I see.
But doesn't it depend on how the individual person is?
Yeah.
We're just speaking
overall.
Yeah, we're speaking overall.
I think that there's sometimes you can generalize, but sometimes somebody's really they're working on a 1920s
issue. Well, absolutely, or 1820, or 1520.
Just trying to come out of the Middle Ages.
Still stuck in the Middle Ages.
And maybe we all have those aspects.
Yeah.
We're at different points in development.
Yeah, for sure.
But certainly things have changed. She wrote. I think she wrote this in late 60s, probably, early 70s. I don't know when the German edition was written. Does it say? No. 1978. Well, still.
78.
Yeah. Originally published as Spiegel und der Zeba in 1978. Anyway, it's an open and important question. Well, then she goes on to a little bit about this figure in the Persian tradition, which I always think is important to look at the Muslim tradition. We really know very little about it. She just alludes to it. You know, her last book was on Arabic alchemy. And doesn't really add that much new here. But over on 157, she says some things that are just helpful in general. Again, excuse me, it repeats the theme of the guide, to lead. And then she says some helpful descriptions of the self. About the middle of that first big paragraph, here too is in the Hermetic philosophy, this personification of the self is the most individual core.
157?
157, first big paragraph, starting about the middle. Here too is in the Hermetic philosophy, this personification of the self is the most individual core of the individual person. And simultaneously, the human self, that is, the self of all humanity. Now that is a huge paradox, and one I would like to investigate in my remaining years. And it's just a statement that you can let work on you. You think of individuality as separate, but it's really where you are joined to what is as an individual. And since you're joined to what is as an individual in a way that fits, then we got to say, fits what? And fits what? That what is somehow there is a bigger dimension of reality that we can be a part of. She'll come back to this idea several times before the end of the book. I think it's, if it's not the first, it's one of the first times she mentions it. So that's a theme that she introduces here. Another theme that she introduces here is the theme of the mirror, which she'll pick up on in more detail as we go along. Becoming conscious of this inner figure means for the soul that it becomes a clear mirror of the image, and from that point on proceeds in its company as with an escort. Now, in other words, there's something in us that shows us who we are. And apparently, it can show us clearly, or it can show us unclearly. And since we live in a time of rabid narcissism, I'm saying it's probably showing us unclearly. People have this huge idea of their importance. And so where are they getting that from? Some reflection of themselves that shows them inaccurately. And we'll be looking at this several times in the rest of the book. I think it's very important, this idea of there is a reflector in us that reflects us to ourselves, and that self is bigger than us. That bit about the self being bigger than us, Jung, as a social phenomenon, Jung didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about, and I think there's room to talk about it. He does allude to it. Okay, so that's sort of a breathing point. You okay so far?
Gary, is she going to go on, or you said sometimes it's clear and sometimes it is not.
Yeah.
Is that based on the times or the individual or both?
I don't know. But think of the thing that has always interested me is the fairy tale Snow White. Why does their mirror support Snow White's mother's pathology? Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest one of all? That mirror is directed solely on her vanity. And that's a problem, which I don't really understand. But that would be an example of the mirror not reflecting clearly. And, you know, the Freudians jump on that and say, well, it shows that the mother didn't sufficiently mirror the child. I don't know if that's exactly adequate, though.
But she's not really her mother.
She's a stepmom. And I don't know if we understand why she's acting that way.
Well, I wondered in that fairy tale about the aspect of evil being the mirror reflecting the vanity, mm-hmm. and that evil playing maybe a positive role in her eventually having to come to some consciousness.
You could look at that. You could, yeah, that's an important point too, that she goes through a development that she wouldn't ordinarily have gone through, namely getting to know the dwarves, had that not happened.
She loses her naivete, too.
And she loses her naivete.
Isn't there a lot about mirrors and Buddhist...
I don't know a lot about that, actually. I think...
There's something about...
Like, that was teaching something of mirrors.
Do that.
There's something about... At some point when you are about to receive enlightenment, you realize... You're always polishing the mirror, and then you realize there is no mirror. That, for some reason, sticks in my mind, but I don't know where it's from or...
It has to do with the illusion. Or
the illusion of the world.
Yeah, we'll pick up on that theme, too, today. Or if not today, soon.
It reminds me of that dream that you had where you went in the chapter. You realized it was him.
He was a yogi's dream. Boy, that's the best example of the self I think you can think of. Everyone knows that dream, probably.
Later on in that chapter, she talks about this writer Corbin.
Yeah.
Saying that each person then will see this individuation in the way in which, by nature, he is fitted to understand it. And so it's going to be different for everyone.
Right.
And maybe some people will only be able to reach a certain level of consciousness, and others...
That for sure. It's when the mirror operates deceptively that puzzles me. Not when the person... Now, you might say, oh, the mirror operates deceptively because the person... is predisposed to see it that way. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. But I would like to also keep the question open. Does the mirror ever just operate wrongly? Not the ego. You could say, well, that is a reflection of the ego's distortion. That's certainly possible. And I'm wondering, are there other reasons?
Well, and could the self... have a distortion.
And could the self have the distortion in and of itself,
right,
from historical reasons or who knows what? Yeah. And to what end? To what purpose? And you just in a way said, well, it furthers her development.
It furthers
Snow White's development.
Oh, yeah.
See, Snow White, just a quick thing, because since we got into it, well, I find it's interesting if you read the story. Remember, her mom pricks the finger?
Yeah.
And it bleeds, and then she wishes for a daughter as white as the snow, with lips as red as the blood, and something else, and black as something other. And then she's okay till the daughter gets to be 7. And see, that's not about sex. That's about the mind. Age of reason, I think, is 7, huh, in the Catholic Church. So when the daughter gets to be 7, it's when she starts persecuting her. And then Snow White has to go live with the dwarves. Mm-hmm. And the dwarves are creativity. So if you dig into the symbolism a little bit, it's the same word in Greek for finger and dwarf. So what the mother wounds, the daughter has to heal. But then, going back to Kathy's point, she would have never met her dwarves had she not, or no, she would have never gotten creative had her mother not persecuted her. It's one of these ironies.
And you hate to think about that. And
you hate to think about that, yeah.
Been through a terrible childhood, mm-hmm. or a terrible trauma or whatever, but sometimes that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so individual where one person can go through that and come out.
Exactly.
Really searching, another person
exactly.
is just stuck in the
situation. Yeah, and so the big question is why? And Is it heredity? Is it, who knows what? These are questions we don't have answers for yet. Anything else? Just breathe there a moment because we start a new idea. And if you're confused now, you'll be worse off. Okay, well, the chapter ends with, in a way, a summary of what does it mean to be conscious of all these things we've talked about. She ends the chapter this way. She picks up the same question and spends the whole next chapter on it. So we've gone now, we're at a transition point, big transition point in the book. We've gone from, when we started out talking about what's the unconscious, and then what's the collective unconscious, and then we got into all these various, the projections from the shadow, projections from the Adam and Adamus. This chapter is on the projections of the self. Now she's going to start talking about, okay, so what's it mean to withdraw those projections? And the last chapter will be, once they're withdrawn, then what? So we're in a transition. We're sort of leaving the look at projections and talking about integrating the projections. And what I like so much here is that she contrasts the nature of withdrawing the projections of the shadow, of the anima and animus, and of the self. Each one's a little different. But remember, take this with a grain of salt. For everything I say, there's an overlap. When I say, oh, I think this is how it is to have insight into the shadow, you can say, well, but I had this dream of an anima and animus, and it sounds similar to what I was dealing with there. Yeah, and I think that's true. So, but we're speaking kind of on average, there's a slight difference in tone in each of these cases, although be aware that they overlap. The shadow. So they're bottom of 157. She says, in the case of the shadow, it is largely a question of humility. See where I am there?
Where are
you? 157, last paragraph, 4 lines down. I'd add to that. Shadow is often about where you're a jerk. So working on the shadow is admitting all the hurtful, inconsiderate, thoughtless, pushy, greedy things that you do. When I do the introduction to Jung thing, some of you have done it, to introduce this material, I'll instead of trying to make it so theoretical, I have everyone think of somebody of their own sex they don't like, and then tell me why they don't like them. And then I collect the cards. I put them in a big pile so nobody knows, you know, who's. And it's too something in a small group. It's too revealing. But what comes up is pushy, greedy, arrogant, inconsiderate, thoughtless,
selfish,
selfish. I started this a long time ago, and before entitlement wasn't such an issue then, but I bet it would come up now. You might say it's owning up to your negative qualities or your negative appearing qualities, and it is a blow to your self-esteem. It's true, there's such a thing as a positive shadow, etc., but we're speaking on the air. Now, with the Adam and Adamus, the plot thickens. Where, in theory at least, you can integrate shadow projections pretty much. In other words, you can change your obnoxious behavior. AA, you know, go around tell people in your environment how you've hurt them and that you're sorry. That's shadow work. And you theoretically can get to the point where you stop that obnoxious behavior. With the am and animus, we have to make a distinction between the process of the anima and animus and the content of the anima and animus. The process of the anima and animus means that when you are ready to develop a certain aspect of yourself, the content will appear as an erotic projection. And once you have integrated that, and it's time for you to develop another skill or creative idea or personality attribute, that another erotic projection will be established until you contemplate the meaning of that and withdraw the projection. That process will never stop. So you could say that the anima and animus can never be integrated. There will always be one more challenge. The contents that the anima and animus throw up can be integrated. But that process whereby they are put in your face through eros will never stop.
So if you are working with this erotic attraction to whatever. What you gain from that reflection on it, why am I attracted to that person, mm-hmm. those qualities, that's the content that then you take into yourself.
Right. Okay. Yeah, the content can be integrated, the process whereby the content is presented to you cannot ever come under your control.
And that's because the anima and animus actually are a bridge between the self and the individual.
Right.
And so that bridge is always hopefully open.
Right. Okay. Now comes the irony. Most of the time, those contents are positive. The shadows are negative. The anima and animus's offers are positive. But, believe me, we fight them just as much as we fight the negative. You would think, oh, thank you for that gift. No. If that were the case, I could never make a living. We say, I don't want to do that. It's too much work. Or, it will make me odd. Or, who will I discuss this with? So even though the tone of the anima and animus is positive, it is just as much a struggle to own up to as the shadow was to endure the embarrassment about.
Because you have to change something.
You got to change something, and usually it's a pain in the ass. After you've changed it, you are mighty glad you did. But the process is a huge battle. And I think the more valuable the content is to your social environment, the harder it is to come to terms with. Because it's creative. But creative means it has no place in the way things are at the moment in the world. It's an addition. It's a correction. And the world doesn't want to be challenged. You could say it's a challenge to the world. Now, we'll see in this Burkhardt's work, his challenge was to paint his dreams. He was a very good portrait painter and sort of the graphic artist. And he had to give all that up and paint from his dreams. And his, I think there were a couple of pictures of his graphic art. I mean, it's beautiful, but it's just, you know, gas stations, or, I know, fruit for a vegetable stand, just very well done. And, of course, he made a lot of money with that. Who wanted to see the pictures of the inner world? So he went through this huge battle, and that was a lot of what he worked with von Franz, to keep the courage up to continue painting and sharing work that at that time nobody was interested in. So, slight difference between the shadow and the anima and animus.
So as a dream comes to kind of correct us, then an individuated person who has accepted their task in life is like that little dream that comes to correct the world.
Yeah, yeah, I really think, and we're, you know, I alluded to that in that quote I just read from the Islam context, that pretty soon particularly when we get to the self, you can no longer look at your own experience apart from its meaning to the times. And so that you've gone in to do this inner work, you've withdrawn a certain amount of attention from the world just because you have to spend time with your dreams, you've got to spend your money, you've got to spend your time, but then that process leads you back out. And to the extent that you're creative and you can share that creative lesson or gift or talent, you become a corrective to the world like the dream was a corrective to you. And as I say, Jung knew that he did not work on that last aspect. He alludes to it, but it really has not been worked out.
Well, he lived it, though.
He lived it. But he was so focused on the inner. He said, I know, I have devoted my attention to the inner, but I also know there's a huge question is, so how does the inner, when it's from the self and the society, interact? Plenty of talk about the ego, but when it's from the self, what's going on? And it's usually a battle, because the society wants, you know, you can almost say the definition of society is what loves inertia.
Could we equate soul with the animus in a way? And
I think you can.
How the soul operates in an individual? I mean, it's just another word for that bridge between the greater self, which is in all of us, and the individual. I'm just trying to make...
That's how I would. This is my definition, and, you know, I read his definition a couple of times, and it never really made sense to me. My definition of the soul is it's the conscious feminine. As opposed... Pardon?
In the women?
Yes, this gets complicated. If we go with this idea, shadow, same sex. Mm-hmm. Animus or anima, contrasexual. Self, a mixture of the two sexes, but... certainly at our age, meaning not somebody who is approaching death, I think the predominance of the self is our own sex. So, I would say for a man, the shadow is masculine. His anima, if it is conscious, would be his soul. And his self would be his spirit. A woman's shadow feminine. Her animus, if it's conscious, would be her spirit. Her self, if it's conscious, would be her soul. That's how I try to describe it. And yeah, it's this idea of...
So what did you say, conscious feminine? Was it the soul?
Yeah, for the woman...
And soul.
It's soul.
Soul.
Yeah. And so that the woman's center is soul, and a man's center is spirit. That's how I understand it, anyway. Really, the man's soul, a man's self is contrasexual. The woman's self is contrasexual. But for most of us, we're going to be dreaming of our own sex when we dream of the self. So that's consciousness of shadow projections, consciousness of Anna's projections, now consciousness of self projections. What's it mean to become conscious of the self? I would say it is knowing what you serve. It's the grail question. And as she says, you can never integrate the self. Maybe unless you're psychotic. I'm serious.
Really, the self has integrated you.
Yeah, I mean, really, I had a woman come in a couple years ago, and she said, hello, I'm so-and-so. I'm God. Oh, yeah. I said, no, you're not. Oh, yes, I am. I said, no, you're not. You're every living being. Goodbye. Mm-hmm. That person had been totally taken over by the self. In the healthy sense, that self has the authority of God, but it is the guide, the taskmaster, all these things we've talked about. You could say the self is the path of your meaning, the path that if you live it in the way you work, in the way you care, leads to a meaningful life. So to integrate and at the same time, see, we're always in the paradox when we get to this self stuff. It is the you who does that. Because, as we've alluded, the self's both in and out. Jung, to be sure, emphasized the inner aspect, but it's also outside of us.
You say it's you that does it, meaning it's the ego that...
Well, no, it's not the ego that it's your individuality that is doing that individual thing which is meaningful, both to you and to your time.
So you're saying it's your psyche's doing this work.
It would be the psyche when you know what the psyche is. One of the big things I feel is so easily leads to misunderstanding is that you sacrifice the ego. I don't think that's adequately expressed, because you have to have a strong ego in order to fulfill the tasks that lead to your meaning. You've got to be responsible. You've got to be able to fight. You've got to be reliable. You have to have endurance. You have to have foresight. What is sacrificed is the illusion that you're calling the shots. And I think Christianity has really done damage here, that to sacrifice for God is to give up worldly pleasure. Wrong answer. Sacrifice for the self is often to dive into the world.
So you said at the same time you have to know you're calling the shots?
That you are not calling the shots. In other words, I might want to be a plumber, but myself wants me to be a carpenter. Well, plumbers make more money. Self doesn't care. Well, that's a silly example, but... So I think integrating the self is getting clear what you are to serve and then serving it. Or you might say what you are to bring to fruition and then bringing it to fruition. And at the same time, it's the you who's doing that. And as you do that, you change. I I think you get quieter. You don't need an audience. Need friends. But let's say at least you don't need as much of an audience. So you can be sure that the loudmouth, look at me, is not in touch with self.
When she says here, no one can accomplish this by simply willing it.
Yes.
It is effective in him by the self. So could we say it's almost an invitation by the self?
Yes.
Because some people are invited and others are not?
I think everybody is.
Everyone's invited?
Mm-hmm. But the book puts it kind of linearly, which is not true. You know, first the shadow. Although, again, if you can imagine that the top of the bell curve, there is a certain truth. You don't get to the self until you work through the other stuff. Although I have seen, and it certainly was the case in my own inner work, to get the self very early in therapy. I mean, images of it show up very early. You just don't have the strength to do what it takes to bring that thing in. So to say, oh, you don't get the self till the end of an analysis, that's wrong, I think. But the fulfillment of this is often a later development.
So it can show up in small ways throughout your whole...
Or even big ways.
Yes, for some people just boom and there it is.
Yeah, there it is. I would say... I hate to generalize, but very often within the first year of inner work, you'll get a wacko dream hitting you over the head. This is what you're about, and you're just not big enough to absorb it. Mm-hmm. And if you weren't big enough to absorb it, you don't have the strength to absorb it. It will piss off your parents. It will piss off your boss. It will create conflict. And you see, if the shadow hasn't been integrated, you can't do it. You just collapse. And if the anima and animus have not been developed, you won't have either the mind or the eros to pull it off.
I just have one other quick little question. Yeah. Is what's the difference between being taken over by an archetype and taken over by the self? Because if we look at Nietzsche,
same.
It's the same thing.
Well, self would be one of those archetypes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to know the difference between being taken over by an archetype like Nietzsche was with Zarathustra or being taken over by the self.
The best example of taken over by the self, isn't it the movie? It's old, but Hairspray? Anyone remember that movie?
They made a musical out of it, didn't they?
Oh, maybe I got the wrong name.
I'm wondering.
Who played that? Ryan O'Neill, I think. And it was about a hairdresser.
Warren Beatty.
Or maybe it was Warren Beatty.
Oh, Warren.
Is that Hairspray? And he can't say no to any proposition from a woman. He's boinking everybody. And it's like he is, you might think, wow, what a great life. But he is at the mercy of his attraction. He can never say, well, I'm going to go read a book tonight. The woman comes along, and he's gone. So that would be an anima possession.
Okay.
The self would be a prophet who is bigger than life, but very destructive in the process. Shadow would be a criminal, possessed by the archetype of the shadow.
Do you withdraw projections of the self, though? I mean, we're talking about withdrawing projections of the shadow.
Yeah. In other words, I might admire... I think you can think of self-projections as admirations of powerful people.
Mm-hmm.
With the shadow, it's a resentment. With the anima and animus, there's some admiration involved, but it's more an erotic fascination with the opposite sex or anyone who's got your erotic attention. And with the self, it's, I would say, more in the area of admiring people for their accomplishments and their power, their position. And yeah,
I think spiritual leaders too, I think.
Spiritual leaders, yeah.
Historical figures.
So could we say fundamentalists, say Christians, are taken over by the image of the self,
yeah,
in Christ?
In Christ, but only one aspect
right.
of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. I remember Edinger saying in one of his talks, something that really helped me when I work with young people, that the more a young person, meaning I think teen, you know, early teen to late teen, the more they have idealizations, the more likely they are to be people of future significant accomplishments. All those accomplishments are existing as admiration. And that just means that they have a lot of potential in them, which they're seeing outside themselves. I think he says that because some Freudian schools just jump on that and say, oh, that's infantile. You know, you're just, you haven't separated from your parents. But what he's saying is, no, that's the self. And the way the self works is to establish idealization. If you talk to, well, not only young people, but you certainly see it in young people, these kids at my French classes, I mean, they all have their teachers they idealize. And that is so important. Hopefully, as we become adults, we begin to realize I have to be the person I admire in other people. But of course, a lot of times it doesn't happen. Hence, we have cults.
Sometimes it is hard. Go ahead.
No, I was cults and idiotic politicians. Yeah.
So is the anima and animus, they're more likely to kind of be carriers of the self in a way?
Well, they at first, yes.
They carry the contrast.
In theory, again, I don't know if it's humanly possible. It certainly isn't in my life. I'm not sure I want it to be possible. If the self wants to become conscious and it has no other means, it will work through the anima and animus, which is the way it starts working. I guess in theory, if you can grasp the self directly, you don't have to go through the anima and animus projection.
And does that happen very often?
I don't know. It just seems to be very boring if it would. I like these projections. I prefer my crucifixion to boredom. But maybe at one point you say, I'm sick of being crucified. I don't know. It hasn't happened to me yet.
Do you think that there's sort of a dual state of being where in order to relate to the self, you indulge in projection, even though consciously you know it's projection?
Yeah.
It seems to me like that might almost be a necessary way of interacting with the
self. I think it is, yeah. Yeah, I think it is.
And yet you're conscious of it.
Yeah.
It's not truly, it's sort of a double state.
Absolutely. You know, again, when Darryl gave that talk on living your nonsense, I think this is what he was getting at.
That you consciously go into it.
You know, this is dumb. There's no good going to come of this. But if I don't, then what?
Am I missing?
And what will I be missing? And you got to be willing to pay the price. I think in time, if one has established some relationship, some bridge to the self, this mitigates. But life is meant to be a series of challenges, and they come through eros. And there's no protection against it, ultimately.
I suppose that eros isn't necessarily attached to another person.
It doesn't have to be, no. Could be. I think very often is. And in a way, the whole sexual revolution has made this whole thing more powerful. People just repressed this stuff 100 years ago. The other little point, I think this paragraph is worth focusing on because it really does sum up much of what we've done. So let me just go back to the top of 158. You can never integrate the self. That's what we've been talking about. That does not mean a total renunciation of one's own freedom. Even before God, man has to reserve the right to a last word. I think that is so important.
Where are you?
158. See where I am? We're flying down. That's the difference between a fundamentalist and a conscious person. Mm-hmm. Fundamentalist says, God told me. And I am always saying, yeah, and what do you think about that? Really. And if the more a person is fundamentalist, the more inflated they are, their experience, they just have no doubt it's the truth. But they could simply be being a puppet of the self.
I read an article in the New York Times yesterday about Antoine.
He's a perfect example.
And they said that he was probably the best example of an early 13th century person.
Yeah. Some of the things he has said, I mean, I try to remember them, but they're so offensive I can't even remember them.
Yeah. And he's Catholic. I didn't know that.
And he's from Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Fortunately, you're in the world too.
Thank you. Yeah, he is. He is, and Rick Perry is the same way.
Yeah.
You know, just these absolute right and wrong moral statements. Very dangerous. But I don't think Romney's any better. Some of the things he has said.
Well, he won't today.
But it has slipped out.
Oh, they caught him in a few.
Yeah, you know, that, and...
He's so slippery, though. I don't even know if I believe the things that he lets slip out. Uh-huh. Or if they're just for the conservative part of the party.
Right. Anyway, you get what I'm driving at. In that sense, also, I think, we've been talking about self as what you serve, but as I've said, it also is about the person who's doing the serving. So in the next sentence, the encounter with the self means, therefore, a deep and far-reaching change in the conscious attitude.
And that can be developing all along.
That is developing all along.
It's not just one day you wake up and you have it.
No. And I think, you know, the art of aging is that you continue on this journey. And it produces humility, generosity, warmth on the one hand, but on the other hand, the ability to say no, to know what you stand for, to not compromise your inner core, to infuriate people who are desecrating what you have come to cherish. It's both poles. The other another point which we alluded to earlier, Maya, she brings up in the next sentence, it is not for nothing that the above described inner daimon is called, among other names, the angel of metanoia. Metanoia is a biblical reference to a complete, metanoia means Greek for a complete change of attitude. Christ brought a metanoia in the Christian framework. Brings with him a withdrawal from the play of Maya, of the world's illusion, an absolute retreat from the world. That needs to be interpreted, I think. I feel it's dangerous in a way because one can prematurely withdraw from the world. And as I understand this, in the broadest sense, go for what you want. Do, and this is where I think Jung and Buddhism are different, go after Maya. Honor that you want something even though you know, well, maybe I shouldn't. Then you'll get your belly full of it and you can say, you know, I don't want it anymore. The danger is that one withdraws still wanting something. And the point is to have your belly full of it and just say, you know, I'm interested in other things. Some of these kids that I've told you I've got to know say to me, now what did you do in the 60s? I said, whatever else was doing, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Do you do it anymore? No. Well, how'd you stop it? I found other interesting things to do. If you can get it out of your system, that's what I would leave you with about withdrawing from Maya. If it's a will, I think it's, from the Western point of view, it's a mistake. Okay, I think that's... Well, then she goes into the... maybe supporting what I just said. Look at the last sentence of that paragraph. Every deep disappointment or disillusionment is, in this sense, a step forward along the way of individuation. If it is accepted with insight and not with resignation or bitterness. Well, you can't be disappointed if you haven't wanted something. But once you have been disappointed, then you can find something else. We'll just finish this chapter and then take a break. The dream, which we talked about, and I don't know if we need to review that, but how from a shift in perspective, one realizes I am an extension of something else. And it's to that I have to be true. And this idea of arrangement over on 159, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines up. Meaning that there's a plan, there's a pattern, this we've all talked about, that the guide, there is something bigger that we are to ascertain and try to respond to, both for ourselves and our world.
Gary, I don't know if this is either here nor there to this discussion. But the woman who came in and said she was God, when you said that, I thought of three different people distinctively. Two said they were God, one said they were the president, and they all were on that borderline cusp of, you know, they know that they're not, but they're not. They act like they are. They think they are. And I was just like, you said go away.
I didn't say go away. She left.
She left. Yeah. How do you deal with those people when you have somebody like that that you're dealing with, that you have to deal with?
The only option is to worship them.
Because that's what they demand.
Gods are, their sole business is to be worshipped and to administer
and
the truth.
And all three of them. Absolutely demand to be worshipped and obeyed at all times.
Mm-hmm. Or get ready to, you know, to get one hell of a battle. Yeah, this woman got furious at me.
It reminded me of what we were studying in the Red Book about when it's inviting God.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a psychotic thing?
Well, it how can I put it? It's a little bit off our discussion, but it's probably worth going into. how does the self work when it's in the process of becoming conscious? Often, it will try to take over the ego. So you can never tell if you look at a dream of the person becoming godlike if they are in the process of feeling the self or in the process of becoming crazy. You got to be damn careful. In other words, where we talked about the shadow hitting us as negative emotions, the anima and animus as experience through negative emotions, the anima and animus through erotic emotion, erotic attraction. The self is often initially experienced as an elation. And you can so easily confuse yourself with the self. And what we've got to do is help the individual realize that thing is in them in one's service. It is not to pump them up and be a big shot.
Yeah, you can think you're wonderful because you're.
You think you're wonderful, okay. Yeah. Versus that you're doing something of value. So I say if you work with somebody who's been totally squashed by life, nothing is of value to them, certainly not themselves. And often when this thing starts to move, they start feeling like they're valuable. Well, they are valuable, but if that's not held in check, they think they're the only valuable thing. And I think the art in working with it is to accept the necessity to feel valuable and then to be somebody of value. And that's a very critical shift. That's exactly what Jung was working with. Yeah. Let's have a stretch.